drawing room.
Over here. Come in, have a seat. Let's have a chat. Afghanistan has been in the news again recently as coalition forces have withdrawn. The Taliban has reclaimed control and there are huge questions about what this will mean for the country, particularly for women. In Tim Bonihady's new book, Two Afternoons in the Kabul Stadium, he looks at the modern history of Afghanistan, the way that cultural symbols and women's rights have changed over the last 100 years, and the way that images have shaped our understanding of the country. Tim is my guest in the drawing room. Tim, welcome.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Paul.
Now, the two events that make up your title, A Great Unveiling and A Brutal Execution, why were these the moments that you were drawn to?
The first of them, the unveiling which you referred to, happened in the Kabul Stadium in 1959. And almost immediately, it was recognised as a kind of iconic event, a symbol of the attempt by the then Afghan government and a succession of Afghan governments which followed to modernise the country. So where women were able to go, where they were seen and what they wore was seen as symbolic of this attempt at modernization. So it was a pivotal event. That's why I was drawn to it. And then almost exactly 40 years later, in the same stadium, as you say, there was the first execution of a woman by the Taliban. Again, the event was conceived by the rulers of the country as a public spectacle. That's why they held it in the stadium, so that there could be a mass audience, which was true of the earlier unveiling. It also became an event of international significance as well as profound significance for Afghanistan, because the execution was covertly filmed by a group of women, and that video which they made had huge impact, particularly around the time in the immediate aftermath of the attacks of 9/11. So these two events in the same place, both conceived as public spectacles, both involving women. In the one case, women having shifted out of wearing chadaris, wearing a kind of modified form of Western dress, their faces visible. And then the contrast with 1999, where you have a woman kneeling in a chidari being executed, the huge impact and importance of those events happening in the same place. That's, I guess, where the book title and in part the structure of the book come from.
Yes, well, the first of these afternoons, as you say, when women appeared in public without the chidari. One of those women was the wife of the Prime Minister, Mohammed Daoud. How significant was that?
It was hugely significant. The women who unveil in the Kabul Stadium in 1959 are all from, I guess, what you would call the Afghan and Kabuli elite. They are women who sometimes are the wives of very prominent figures, like the then effective ruler of Afghanistan, Mohammed Daoud. Sometimes they are the daughters or the daughters-in-law of very powerful men. And so in a kind of way, it was a form of maybe what you could call sort of like a top-down form of modernization, where women from the ruling elite wanted to unveil. The government supported them in that. And there was then a really long period, really until the fall of the communist government of Najibullah in 1992, where that attempt at modernization and a profound shift in the place of women in, particularly in Kabul, in urban Afghan society, and Kabul more than anywhere else, where that attempt to change urban society in Afghanistan persisted from that first afternoon.
Interestingly, the Shadari was originally, I mean, much has been said, obviously, in discussions around the burqa, the Shadari, the veil in recent years. Much has been commented upon it, but it was the Shadari originally a marker of class as well as religion, wasn't it?
That's right. I mean, the chidari was an expensive garment and could be a very expensive garment depending on the materials and the embroidery and the very sort of nature of it, the amount of material it used, but then in ways how sort of confining and restrictive it was. It was a garment for women who were not working. So it was all so in its origins, as you say, it was a garment of privilege.
How much did the Shadari matter of itself, and how much was it a symbol of other conditions?
It was a symbol both within Afghanistan and internationally. So, over a long period before the unveiling in 1959, there were a small group of women and Afghans more generally who wanted to sort of shed the chidari. And internationally, and this was both true then and it was true when the Mujahideen gained power in 1992, and even more when the Taliban gained power in 1996, internationally, the chidari and the requirement that women wear the chidari was seen as a mark of oppression and of Afghanistan's benightedness.
Yes. A photo by Lawrence Brun of three women in miniskirts in Afghanistan in the 1960s became a huge symbol after 9/11 of what Afghanistan had been and could be. But what was the societal context that we didn't see in that image?
The image of these three women, I think it was actually taken in the early 1970s, in 72, I think. What is missing from that photo, which, as you say, had huge impact and was taken as a kind of symbol of the liberalisation, modernisation of Afghanistan, which had happened in that period from 1959. The same photographer, Lawrence Brun, who was the first Western photographer to live in Afghanistan for an extended period, a Swiss-French photographer who had a particular interest in the photography of women, as part of that photography, took a series of just as compelling photos of young women taking part in May Day rallies and being at the forefront of leftist political protests. So the same society which was embracing fairly modest versions of the miniskirt was also a complex society which was in which there were a multiplicity of leftist groups, including Maoists, groups aligned with Moscow, and May Day was the day more than any other where those groups took to the streets and displayed their politics.
But there was also significant pushback within Afghanistan toward those wearing the miniskirts, acid attacks and beatings of the sort of women depicted in that photo, I understand.
Exactly. So, as part of the complexity of that society, people who one might regard as more traditionalists or fundamentalists, for them, the miniskirt was the symbol of Afghanistan's corruption by the West. And there was huge debate over the miniskirt, but there were also a small number of opponents of the miniskirt who, in a kind of way, which, as you say, doesn't, you can't see in the photo of the three young women were walking happily and confidently through Kabul in those miniskirts, is that those women like them also lived in a degree of fear. They were subject to attack. There was a mullah who engaged in a series of shootings, and there was an extended period where women who wore Western dress were subject to acid attacks.
On Radio National, I'm Paul Barclay, filling in for Patricia Karvelas. Tim Bonahady is my guest in the drawing room. We're talking about Afghanistan art and his new book, Two Afternoons in the Kabul Stadium. And Tim, another kind of an example of the complexity of this story was Dowd himself, because he may have been a liberalizing force to some extent, but he was also rather an autocrat, wasn't he?
That's right. I mean, this was a period where, well, he initially was prime minister under King Zahir Shah, and he was the effective ruler of Afghanistan when there were no elections, when King Zahir Shah instituted constitutional reform. The king exercised most power in the country. The parliament had very little power. And then Dowd came back. He staged a coup and ousted the king, who was his first cousin, in 1973, and he effectively became the dictator of Afghanistan.
Okay, the other afternoon in Kabul Stadium was far darker than the first, as you've already pointed to. Take us into that second day and the execution of Zamina.
There had been a long period before Zamina's execution in 1999 where, I guess, groups, the Mujahideen and then the Taliban, had staged public punishments of people who flouted their laws. And this is documented to a certain extent already in the 1980s when the Mujahideen were fighting the communists and trying to take power. Once the Mujahideen captured Kabul in 1992, there were a small number of these punishments staged publicly. They happened in a park in Kabul. There were executions elsewhere. There were amputations of those who had been accused and convicted of stealing. And once the Taliban took power in 1996, there was a ramping up of those public punishments. 1998 was the year where there were more of those punishments than any other year. There were still probably not as many as happened in Saudi Arabia, but there was a dramatic increase, and the Taliban searched Kabul, I guess, or experimented in Kabul for appropriate venues. There was a major traffic intersection. There was an oval, a soccer oval at a school, which they tried. But it was a period where Kabul only had one stadium, and so it was a crucial venue, and had been for a long period for major political events and for sporting events, used on all manner of occasions. And the Taliban turned it into their main place for public punishments. They typically did so on Fridays. They conjoined it often with games of soccer. So there were these sort of two very different kinds of events. And in 1999, by 1999, the stadium had shifted from being a venue where only men could attend to a venue where there was a small restricted area purely for women. And when the Taliban announced that they would be executing this woman who was accused, or under their system had been convicted of murdering their husband, there are many questions about the nature of Taliban justice. In all these cases, the accused were said to have freely admitted their guilt. There are many questions, you know, in terms of not having what we would think of as appropriate legal representation. But when the Taliban announced that they were going to execute a woman for the first time, a group of women who belonged to a group called RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of Women of Afghanistan, illicitly got hold of a video camera. And it's one of the interesting things about the Chidari, that the Chidari had over a long period become a kind of vehicle for subterfuge. Mujahideen trying to smuggle weapons into Kabul in the 1980s, disguised themselves as women and hid weaponry under the Chidari. And in this case, a group of women went into the Kabul stadium with the video camera hidden under one of their chidaris, which they were compelled to wear by the Taliban. And in this arena where there wouldn't have been the male guards and quite the scrutiny which there would have been elsewhere in the stadium, they were able to take a short, shaky, but extraordinarily powerful and compelling video of the execution of Zamina.
Yes, and that vision of the execution really had a profound impact on the international view of Afghanistan, didn't it?
It did, but it's one of these episodes which I think are really interesting in terms of the power of the visual, which is that once this group, RAWA, had taken the video and they had smuggled the video into Pakistan where they had members and they had put it up on the internet, there was a long period where they couldn't get international news channels to screen it. They tried repeatedly. News channels said it was too shocking. And it was only in 2001, before 9/11, that an independent British documentary company called Card Cash decided to make a program about the Taliban, and they got permission to use that video. Their program called Beneath the Veil was screened not only in England and the United States, but also by the ABC. It was shown on Four Corners just before 9/11. And it did have some impact. Viewers were shocked by the footage of the execution, but it still had no political traction when that documentary was first shown in mid-2001. And it was only after 9/11 that it became, I guess, one of the most powerful sort of pieces of evidence of what the Taliban were like. And it's a kind of example of how images, the visual is not inherently powerful. For it to have political traction depends on a broader context. And if the context isn't there, an image which might have great power might never get seen or only be seen by very few people. And it's that you can then have a transformation, as happened with 9/11, where it, you know, it became one of the most seen bits of footage on CNN in the United States.
Where do you think, you quote W.J.T. Mitchell, who observes that wars are fought over images, with images, by means of images. Where does the image fall then, and I take your point about context, in our understanding of the world and in our understanding of places like Afghanistan?
I think there it does a number of things. The images are one of the most significant forms of document or record of what has happened. They may be staged, they may be doctored or confected in various ways, but they remain one of the most significant and potentially powerful and revealing documents we have. They are also, if you think of war rugs, which form a significant part of my book, they can also be not only a document, but they can be an expression of people's hopes and fears and beliefs. And then they also can become central to our politics. So the footage which we just talked about of the execution of Zamina does that. The photograph of the miniskirted women in Kabul can do that. And the issues around the issues, I guess, more generally about the visual. One might think that what people wear, is not a matter or shouldn't be a matter of high politics. That it's a the decision to wear a miniskirt, one might think, is a small fashion statement. But depending on the nature of the society, that can be at the center of politics. And then for the international community, when it comes to Afghanistan, whether we see Afghan women in chadaris or whether we see them in Western dress has been, and I think will remain, central to how we see and understand and judge the country.
Yes. Tim, thank you very much for talking with us on Radio National.
It's been a pleasure, and thank you for giving me the opportunity.
And plenty more, I should say, that you'll get from Tim Bonihady's book, Two Afternoons in Kabul Stadium. It's out now through Text Publishing. Tim's been our guest in the drawing room.